Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. Upcoming episodes include Hendrick's Gin, Magnum Ice Cream Bars, and their new campaign to create new and unexpected use occasions. Hyatt Hotels for the Stay campaign. Ryanair, which is the Irish airline with a wonderfully cantankerous social media edge. Audible by Amazon. And Pepsi's rebrand with CMO Mark Kirkham. We also have episode two in our CMO series, which has been a great hit. We did the first one on Heineken, and also our marketing effectiveness series, volume two, is coming up with a string of great guests, including Les Bennett, Sarah Carter, Adam Morgan of the Challenger Project, Jorge Ruiz, Global Head of Marketing Sciences at TikTok, and Sarin Panitalet, Senior Director of Marketing Effectiveness at Mars. And if that wasn't enough, we're now producing a series on agency procurement. That's going to be senior marketers alongside their procurement counterparts. It's going to feel like an episode of Fight Club, I think. I'm kidding, of course. If you'd like to be a sponsor of any of our series or shows, you can download our sponsor kit on our homepage at onstrategyshowcase.com. Because when it comes to reaching the industry, you do have a choice. You can spend tens of thousands sponsoring low-reach, low-engagement industry events or conferences, or be right here, where we offer a significantly higher number of engaged senior marketers and agency leaders every month at a far better value. We're actually the perfect low-waste solution for those trying to promote products and services to decision makers in this industry. Shows like ours only exist because of sponsor support, so we would love to hear from you. That said, here's a clip from today's episode.
The shared emotionality of the fact that everybody around 4 o'clock is like, ugh, what am I going to have for dinner, including our favorite celebrities, I think created, you know, this sort of like shared pain point around
a ritual, food. Right?
Yeah, this ritual that it didn't matter who you were or what you were doing at around 4 o'clock, this happened to everybody. And that sort of universal access and that voyeurism of, well, I'm thinking about, you know, what I want for dinner. I wonder what, Rebel Wilson is thinking about what she's going to have for dinner. Kim Kardashian is thinking about what she's having for dinner. And I think the unlock of that idea became so special because it just felt like there was this universal truth throughout, you know, the entire universe, no matter who you were, that figuring out what you wanted for dinner was a pain point.
That's Danielle Hawley, head of global brand and creative at Uber. She's joined by Celia Garforth, head of strategy at Special in Australia. We're going to talk about the genesis of Tonight I'll Be Eating and the transition of the Uber Eats brand beyond food into grocery with its Uber Don't Eats campaign and the most recent Get Almost Anything Work. And we're also going to talk about how the brand and the agency think about effectiveness. You can see all of the Uber work on our website at onstrategyshowcase.com. Here's Danielle and Celia. Enjoy. It's important to reflect on the fact that delivery, particularly food delivery in the past, prior to a lot of these apps, was really very much a sort of store specific. So you wanted Chinese food, you wanted Thai food, you wanted pizza, you called those places and then they had their own drivers. And it was very much driven by their particular sort of fleets. And of course, that's all dramatically changed. And so I'm really thrilled to have both of these guys here to talk about it. Welcome, Danielle.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It is great to have you. And Celia, welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Thank you. I am a long-time listener and first-time guest, so extremely excited to get into it with you.
It's very simplistic to think that, okay, we had this Uber app, we have the rideshare app, we had this network of vehicles and drivers, and therefore, wow, it was pretty easy then to say, okay, what else can these drivers carry? They could carry and deliver food. And at that time, it was a really interesting twist because delivery was associated with just getting it from, you know, you got your pizza from Domino's or from wherever, This idea that now your Uber driver can deliver food to you at the time was a really interesting thing. And so the thought could be, well, was it just as simple as adding in new functionality? Well, hell no. You had to have built a network and a system and a completely different operation. And it seems like that was very native to Uber, but a lot of it wasn't, right, Danielle? There had to have been a steep learning curve about how to run these businesses separately yet together.
I think that there are certainly things on the back end that make it a very attractive business. I mean, certainly, I think that you're right in that we have this army of people who are ready to either pick you up or bring you something at the ready, which means that the operational efficiency of the things that make Uber Uber, like tap a button, get a thing, or get a ride, get a meal, whatever it may be, or just the idea that there is cross-sell, upsell, there is opportunity on the back end to make it more efficient for people, to think about things like Uber One, that's a membership that actually saves you on rides and eats. There's a lot of synergies and work that we've done to actually, I think, leverage the things about the business that are actually very much the same. Operationally, it's really not that different, especially in the earner app, as it were. Riders and couriers ultimately have a very similar experience, or at least the functionality of the experience makes it very easy for them to be either a rider or a courier. In fact, there's many who switch between them on their shifts, depending on time of day or best places to earn. So in terms of the business and the operational efficiency, I think that was very much there and inherent. In terms of the brand, I think pulling it closer together about us being a movement company also allowed us to think about things like transportation as a barrier. You know, we're certainly not going to be in the business of saying what people should and shouldn't do, but we are going to say that if transportation is the reason you can't, that's not okay. We're going to make sure that there's a way that we make it easy for people to get to a voting poll or to get to a vaccine or to get to a job interview or to get to healthcare. And you can imagine that opens up a lot of opportunities to not actually have to change the business or the operations very much to offer more and more services to people as a movement company.
When this initiative, this new business initiative, starts out for Uber Eats, what's the landscape like back then? Because Uber Eats was not the first app to market for food delivery, online food delivery.
No, it definitely wasn't. It launched in around 2015. So first in the US, then rapidly expanded to the UK, France, a bunch of APAC markets. So Asia Pacific, Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, and then here in Australia, that was around 2016. So actually in the majority of markets, Uber Eats wasn't the first food delivery app. So usually kind of actually the second, third, or even fourth to enter the category behind players like you had Deliveroo, you had Postmates, Foodpanda was a big Asian and is a big Asian player. Some markets had pretty established local incumbents. Here in Australia, we had Menulog. They'd been here for about 10 years or so. Same in Japan. There was actually a local food delivery brand that had been launched in the 90s. So the category was essentially still very nascent everywhere at that stage. But there were kind of a lot of sort of niche players.
Had any drive share brands gotten into that space? Had Lyft gotten into it at all? Or were others in it? Or was it still very much a vertical?
That's an interesting question. I actually think all of those that I mentioned were single vertical players. I don't know if there are any other rideshare brands that have gotten into food delivery.
I know there aren't now, but I don't know that there wasn't any attempt years ago. I'll be honest about that. No, and I think that's been part of, you know, speaking to your question about the different lines of business and the different brands. And I think that's been the hardest thing to communicate, right? Is like, we have a DoorDash and a Lyft inside one Uber.
That's pretty
profound.
Was it a difficult decision to decide upon that you guys are aware of, or was it a simple decision?
You know, I wasn't here when the decision was made. The funny stories that I do hear are things like, in the early days, there was a laptop that was running in the office that was like, don't close the laptop because that's where Uber Eats is running. it was startup culture. It was like, yeah, sure, let's try it. And that, I think, speaks to the culture of what Uber early days were very much about. It was just, yeah, sure, let's try it. I think now that culture is a lot more mature and a lot more progressive. But again, I think speaking to the technology itself, this organization has such a palpable understanding of our tech stack. They have such a palpable understanding of our MAUP functionality. It is truly a tech-born company. So thinking about ways to reuse that tech to offer more solutions or more lines of business or more services to more people is always top of mind.
So let's talk about the ads, the ad and the marketing side of this, because number one, why is Special the agency worldwide? What was so special about Special for Uber?
Oh, that's a good one.
I'll let you take that one, Danielle.
Again, I wasn't here. I think that as with many marketing relationships, I think that, you know, Georgie Jeffries continues to be a major, major go-getter and just a brilliant marketer. And she was handed an opportunity that she wasn't satisfied with. And when she met the folks at Special, she instantly had a chemistry with them and a sense of relief about finding like-minded people to build, you know, her vision of the brand, but to do it together. And I think that symbiotic relationship in a market like Australia, where you could have so much impact right away, forged a really special bond. And they were able to innovate and build a partnership that I think was very unique to the way agencies and clients used to work, and it certainly has now spread across the globe. Special Group works in the majority of APAC. And then again, we have a similar relationship with Special Group LA. And that happened because, you know, Georgie hopped from Australia to then APAC and then over to the US, and Special just sort of came with the program. And I know I'm certainly glad that that is the way it worked out.
So let's talk about the very beginnings of this. You guys decide to get into this business. The relationship has started. Celia, talk about those early days. You're given an ask. What is it, and how do you begin to plan for it?
At that time, you know, as we were talking about, it was a very nascent category. We were actually fourth to enter the very tiny online food delivery category here in Australia. Awareness of the brand was tiny. It was around 40%. I would say probably half of that was probably misattribution to the Uber rideshare brand anyway. So the task was really kind of, we're fourth to market. We need to build and grow a distinctive brand really, really, really fast. And as well as doing a really hardcore category normalization job to disrupt those entrenched offline takeaway behaviors that had been around for decades. And at the time, I'd say category marketing was what we called this real sea of sameness. There was lots of, food porn. So lots of beautiful imagery of food with functional benefits plastered all over the top. It was very much driven by lower funnel and performance marketing, lots of sign-up offers, lots of rational claims, lots of explainers. It was fairly vanilla, unexciting. As Danielle mentioned, Georgie Jeffries, who was our marketing client here in Australia at the time, she had a much bigger, bolder vision for that into true Uber style, like properly disrupt that, but not just disrupt from a product perspective, but also a brand and marketing perspective. I would say selection, as in the ability to access a wide range of food for delivery all in one place, was absolutely the most important category benefit of online food delivery versus old school takeaway. So that was the starting point strategically, but we needed to find a way to do it differently and much more interestingly than everyone else, so that we could cut through that sea of food porn. The unlock really came from a couple of key data points. So first, there was some research around people's attitudes to deciding what to have for dinner each night. And it really showed that far from, you know, finding it the highlight of the day, which it should be, it was actually quite stressful and more of a chore than a joy. So that felt like a real opportunity to bring a bit of fun and excitement back into that dinner time decision-making process. And then the second was actually just looking at category usage data. And even though people were claiming in all these research groups that they couldn't wait to take advantage of the selection at their fingertips, in reality, they kept on just ordering, you know, the same old pizza, Thai food over and over again, this time just through an app. And
So this is important to dwell on for a second. So people in research are saying, oh man, when I have all of these choices in front of me, it's going to be this Nirvana world for me, and it's going to be fantastic. But in reality, they would still order pizza through your app. The same, they weren't exploring and discovering. They were going back to their habitual behaviors.
At that time, yes, and it has come over time. But I think there was some data point at the time, even.
And I'm sorry to say this, but it's just for the listener. And the reason we're leaning and dwelling on this is because the category was communicating in a way that delivered the opposite. It was selling choice, variety, but it wasn't reflecting the reality of the way people were using the apps.
Exactly that, yes. And, you know, there was still a normalization job to do in getting people to be inspired by using all these choices. But really, like, that's if you think about the way you use takeaway and food delivery, even now, like, you order this from the same few places over and over again. That has stayed true, even though the category has matured. And I think that kind of really led to this insight that people kind of like the idea of access to a huge selection of dinner options a lot more than the reality of it. And it is aspirational in theory, but in the moment, this endless selection was actually kind of leading to choice paralysis. And people like their favorites. People have their favorites for a reason. But this really pushed us to kind of elevate this benefit of selection into a much more emotional benefit. So instead of just talking about all this, you know, the functional selection that you could access, it was about capturing the feeling that access to all that selection provides, because it is an amazing feeling, you know, like that pure unapologetic indulgence that comes with knowing you can order whatever you want for dinner.
Well, let me stop you there for a second just to understand a little bit more. I've got to imagine that when you discover the fact that behaviors were not reflecting stated attitudes, that
not a shocker.
But I got to imagine you felt a little bit liberated because that's what everybody else was doing. But I got to think there's a part of that that's also like, well, shit, what do we do? So I've got to think before you decided to take a different angle on selection and the emotional driver, did you look elsewhere? Did you think of other things that you might want to do and then they didn't work out, but you went there and checked it out before you ended up going in the direction you did?
Yeah, I mean, selection is such a powerful cool. And remember, at the time we had to, you know, explain to people what this was. We also had a lot of, you know, partnerships with our restaurants and, you know, they wanted to be featured in the campaigns at that time. And so it was going to be quite difficult to move away from selection. It was the core category benefit. But yes, you know, leaning into more like immediacy, for example, and convenience were places we explored. So yes, there were a lot of different avenues explored, but ultimately I think really the magic of that feeling of indulgence and selection, that you can order, you know, literally anything you want for dinner that night, felt like a really powerful space for us to own. And that's essentially what we set about to celebrate through the Tonight I'll Be Eating campaign.
So Danielle, anything you'd add to this?
Yeah, I mean, certainly wasn't there for the beginning, but have worked on my fair share of Tonight I'll Be Eating campaigns as we ported it over to some of the other countries. I think that, you know, whether this is Monday morning quarterbacking about the strategy of Tonight I'll Be Eating or not, Celia can call my bluff if I'm speaking out of turn here. But I think it was also like the shared emotionality of the fact that everybody around 4 o'clock is like, ugh, what am I going to have for dinner? Including our favorite celebrities, I think created, you know, this sort of like shared pain point around
a ritual,
food.
Right?
Yeah, this ritual that it didn't matter who you were or what you were doing, at around 4 o'clock, this happened to everybody. And that sort of universal access and that voyeurism of, well, I'm thinking about, you know, what I want for dinner. I wonder what, you know, Rebel Wilson is thinking about what she's going to have for dinner. Kim Kardashian is thinking about what she's having for dinner. And I think the unlock of that idea became so special because it just felt like there was this universal truth throughout, you know, the entire universe, no matter who you were, that figuring out what you wanted for dinner was a pain point. And that doesn't necessarily establish the strategic role of selection, but the ability to then use the selection as executional consideration. And tonight I will be eating X, Y, and Z thing. Tonight I'll be eating spaghetti carbonara from X, Y, and Z restaurant allowed us the avenue creatively to talk about different menu items from different restaurants.
Tonight, I'll be eating ham and pineapple pizza with extra pineapple and a garden salad. Girls gotta eat.
Which tonight I'll be eating is just a container for as many restaurants and as many menu items as you want to add into the executions, which is what made it a platform that you could do for so long.
In its execution, it's unique, but in its core idea, was what makes that different than what the other places were doing? Celia, I mean, is there something in that that was like, okay, we've got this observation, we've got this sort of, we've got this, what do we talk about? Is it a ritual, which is wonderful. Is it all about execution then, that you created a unique way at it through execution?
I think everything Danielle said is exactly right. And that was the creative insight that we ran at as well, around like this 4 p.m. moment. We even, you know, our entire media strategy in year one was around owning like that dinner time decision-making moment with kind of media targeting and just getting people to think of us when they thought of dinner. It was definitely a much more elevated place in terms of really capturing the emotion for dinner versus, you know, just showing people lots and lots of different food. We actually made a really bold decision to not actually include food in the ads. Like, it was barely featured. You make the order and the bag arrives and nobody is seen eating food. And that was a deliberate decision, not to fall into the tropes of the existing category and just showing lots and lots of food. It was about selling the experience, not loads and loads of different types of food. And that was a really critical kind of, I guess, comms decision in bringing it to life. And then really owning that dinner time decision moment and dinner time occasion. So that was the core category usage occasion at the time. It still is. When people think of ordering dinner, they should instantly think of Uber Eats first, and being really salient for that occasion and being the first brand that comes to mind was absolutely like critical to becoming kind of the number one brand quite quickly.
So Danielle, were there certain executions in that early work that when you look back at it, you may not have been involved in it, but is there some favorites that you like? Which ones are they?
Oh, I think everybody would say Kim and Kath. For
yeah,
sure.
It was brilliant.
Tonight, I'll be eating pesto gnocchi and garlic bread to keep me carbed up. Hey Kim, what are you going to have?
Tonight, I'll be eating a chicken schnitty with chips and chicken salt.
Ooh, nice.
Nice.
Kim, I don't mean to be rude, but it's actually pronounced nice.
Nice?
Nice.
Noice.
N-I-C-E, nice.
Noice.
Noice. Like ice. I like you. Rice, pine lime splice, thrice, moist, dice.
I literally have no idea what you're saying.
It's a Queen's English.
Celia, remind me, but like there was an insight about the duos as well, because, you know, the campaign started as a single person, you know, Naomi Watts walking down the stairs talking about what she was going to have for dinner that night. And then it moved into these unlikely pairings, these duos of people that you never knew you always wanted to see in an ad together. And Kim and Kath, I think, were, you know, just a perfect example of that. But I think there was an insight that came out where it was like either food was dinner time was more fun when you were sharing it with someone else, or you were more likely to order takeout with someone else, which was like a discovery, because you would think of, you know, takeaway as being sort of a solo act of like, I don't want to cook because it's just me. But I don't know if you remember, Celia, but I know that there's lore of that around the Uber Eats world.
I do remember. It was because the majority of orders were solo orders. And so it was quite a strategic decision to increase basket size, essentially, and start showing people like socialized eating and try and normalize the act of kind of socialized ordering of Uber Eats together, you know, as a means of increasing basket size and moving out of just being pigeonholed as something that you do on your own. You know, even in house shares, people were just ordering two separate orders of Uber Eats, like to the same house share. So, I think the other thing with that is just that it brought so many more opportunities for entertainment in having two celebrity two celebrities eating together. Yeah. And that's amazing.
For sure.
It is amazing. Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Hi there, my name's James Herman, and I'm what's known as a distinctive asset, which is something that makes people think immediately of a certain brand, like the Golden Arches make people think of McDonald's, or the Swoosh makes people think of Nike. When the most effective marketing and advertising people hear me, they think of the Master of Advertising Effectiveness brand. The Master of Advertising Effectiveness is a six-week online program in partnership with WARC, where I'll give you a next-level understanding of how to make advertising that creates consistently better commercial results. One important ingredient is distinctive assets, like me. And me being here on this ad is one of the many reasons this campaign is
the most effective advertising campaign in the world.
Confused? You won't be when you become a Master of Advertising Effectiveness. Get started at mae.academy. That's mae.academy.
Now back to the show. So in addition to that, that sort of recognition that single orders could be turned into to group orders, were there any other learnings in that first year or two of the Tonight I'll Be Eating campaign that are notable?
I mean, so many. I think, you know, it was, I mean, it was a six years that that campaign ran. RIP. You know, it, so many different markets. So many different learnings. I would say salience is everything, is the first. So especially in, you know, a low interest and commoditized category, you can, you know, if you focus on owning that core category benefit and occasion, and then just prioritize salience and entertainment above all else, you can actually build your brand as a competitive advantage where there may not be necessarily a really strong product advantage. Commitment to distinctive brand assets and making sure they're baked into to all the brand storytelling and just being so instantly recognizable. And just being really ruthlessly consistent with simple and single-minded, you know, product messaging, and unequivocally just making sure everyone knows what your simple message is, and building heaps and heaps of entertainment around that and making it emotional. You know, and knowing that functional messages don't equal functional advertising. And we have this debate all the time in terms of where does the emotion come from, but it doesn't actually have to come from the message itself. It can be what you build around that message. And if you build heaps of entertainment, humor, and around your messages, you can drive emotion and cut through.
So let's talk about one of those terms you just mentioned, because I know that you guys feel it's pretty core to the way you've executed, and it's the idea of entertainment. Tell us about what you mean by, it's not just simply entertaining. There's a strategic role that you sort of give to that term, right?
You know, what's funny is that we've actually started to coin the phrase entertaining commercialism. And it's something we just use internally. It's not, certainly not something that we, you know, think is consumer facing. It's just marketing speak for, I think, the thing that we've really been able to unlock on Uber Eats, which is this, look, I think that there has been a backlash in our, you know, in our industry about like that shaming selling. It's like, we have a job to do. We got to get people to order food. And somehow we've really landed on like, you cannot watch an Uber Eats ad, no matter what campaign it is, no matter where it is in the globe, and not get the message. Whether it's a promo message, whether it's a selection message, whether it's a cultural message, like a rallying cry around dinner time, you cannot leave an Uber Eats ad without knowing, and frankly, even an Uber ad now, but an Uber Eats ad for sure, without getting the message. But you're so entertained that you don't mind being hit over the head with the message. And that is not easy to do in creative execution.
Yeah, and the other part of it is, which I think is important to note for the listener, is that you're not using celebrity for the sake of designing it all around the celebrity. This is really not about the celebrity. It's the celebrity as part of the message, Celia, right? Is that the best way to distinguish between it? Because celebrity is obviously a huge part of this program.
Yes. I mean, we can talk, we can go to town talking about how Uber uses celebrities. I would say it's always in service of an idea and not a replacement for an idea. And I think through Tonight I'll Be Eating, they've always been kind of short-term protagonists and they've never become brand ambassadors. We've never used the same celebrity twice. You know, they're there to play kind of a heightened version of themselves, and they always really play themselves. They're not playing characters. But they are just protagonists in kind of our story and our ideas. They are not a replacement or an idea in themselves.
In addition to that, I think it's about this change in our culture where we don't have the same celebrities anymore. You know, I think part of the reason that you saw Super Bowl in the United States this year have so many, you know, very, very big stars, Beyonce, et cetera, even Jen Aniston for us, was very much like Friends is nostalgic. You saw a lot of nostalgic celebrities because the times in which we sat around and all watched the same shows, it just doesn't exist anymore. There's influencers, there's TikTok celebrities, there's so many different people that are considered celebrity based on who you're talking to or what audience group or where you live or how old you are, that finding the synergies of celebrities is becoming, I think, harder and harder, and yet even more important as media becomes so fragmented.
I'm just going to remind the listeners, because I'd forgotten some of these people associated with this. There's Kim Kardashian, there's Helen Mirren, there's Tom Felton, there's Michael Cera, there's Robert De Niro, there's Idris Elba, there's the Beckhams, there's Boy George. I mean, there is, it goes
it
on and
really
on and on.
It makes us really fun at dinner parties. What do you think people
sure
ask Delia and I about?
but here's the thing. You guys obviously have a very large investment in creative development and talent investment. Let's briefly talk about wear out. Do you feel that these spots can be used over and over and over again? Or do you feel that they run for a short period of time and then you can't reuse them? Because, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the industry now about wear out. Do ads really wear out as quickly as we think? When you have this high level of investment, is that something that's on your mind?
I can go first, Celia. I'm sure you have a point of view on this too. Here's what I think. I don't think campaign platforms wear out as quickly as we think they do. I do think ads can wear out. And it's just the nature of the way that linear TV is bought and the way that, you know, streaming services and everything included has, I think, cornered our ability. But I will also tell you this, in that part of the reason that we go into the deep, dark holes of things like Australian Open, which are big, major media eyeball events, right? They're big, major moments where we can actually get people to all be watching one thing. Super Bowl is certainly the same way. The amount of eyeballs that you get in a media moment like that are absolutely worth the investment. But then I think the strategic point of view of how we use celebrity, that's core to the brand of Uber Eats, like you said, it's idea first, it's celebrity second, allows us, again, an incremental, like exponential reach through those celebrities that we would be silly not to use. So, you know, when all the chips are down, the amount of reach that we say, you know, that we got from the virality of, say, the Beckhams was absolutely worth the investment. We have to be very strategic and mindful about what we create. So I think the fallacy is that we created a teaser and a Super Bowl spot. The truth is we created over 90 assets. And the way that those are used through the go-to-market plan is very intentional and also, you know, specific to justifying the investment. It's like, we can't just go and spend that kind of money and come back with two assets. And we don't. We go and we make as much possible content as we can from the days of the shoot that we have.
A couple of years in, I think we're speeding up now to roughly 2022, when there's the extension of the business, the expansion of the service into things beyond food. Why that choice? I mean, it seems totally smart, but it puts you into a whole different competitive world. You're now competing against Amazon, Walmart, Target, Kroger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not just about food delivery. Tell us a little bit about that decision and the strategic sort of challenges that resulted from it.
I think that the decision was somewhat clear in that we had this ability to offer more to the people that use our service. I mean, we've been talking about this army of earners, this app that's very malleable and easy to create new ways in. And the selection just expanded from selection of restaurant foods to retailers, et cetera, grocery, convenience. So the expansion, I think, was pretty obvious in that it's just like we do new products and mobility. It was essentially new selection criteria for the Uber Eats side. The challenge was obviously in the name. How are we going to tell people that we, you know, a brand called Eats that was known widely as Eats is now going to sell you things that you do not eat? And changing the behavior to think about, you know, that you could order your meal for tonight to you could order anything was certainly a strategic leap and a repositioning for the brand holistically.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people would have freaked out about that. A lot of people in the marketing services industry would be like, oh my God, well, you can't go to market with Uber Eats when you're doing something. So there's a ton to be learned here about the fact that you can just change context and that there's implicit meaning. Not everything has to be taken literally, right?
Totally. Yeah, I fully agree with that. I think we invest a lot of, names become fairly meaningless quite quickly. It's the meaning that you build around them versus the words themselves. And I think some of the work that was done in the States around kind of actually just playing with the name and kind of changing it to Uber Don't Eats
was super funny. Smart.
But it's just obvious. And so I think just, you know, that goes to kind of the self-deprecating tone that has been built for this brand, which is, you know, people are going to say it. So we should just say it ourselves and point it out and be in on the joke instead of, you know, essentially being the brunt of the joke.
Wait, if it was delivered with Uber Eats, does that mean I can eat it?
It says eat.
It's a diaper.
This tastes bad.
This candle tastes funny.
I feel like eat it.
Not bad, but funny.
And thanks to Uber Eats, we don't even know what food is anymore.
This isn't food.
Can you guys give us a little bit of backstory into how you executionally moved from tonight I'll be eating into get almost anything? What changed in how you thought about how you needed to execute?
I mean, we carried as much from the original brand and the tonight I'll be eating campaign and the core strategy of owning a selection message, but, you know, elevating it into a space of celebrating indulgence. It's, you know, from getting anything you want for dinner to getting anything you want whenever you want it. Essentially, it's the same core emotional benefit and functional selection message, but you know, with a new set of categories that we're moving into and a new way to think about the brand. And it was really, you know, you look at the work now and it's a cousin to the original Tonight I'll Be Eating work. You know, we carried across the playing with the celebrity pop culture, the entertainment built around a simple product selection message, the distinctive brand assets, the delivery bag, the doorbell, the green. And of course, you know, that irreverent self-deprecating tone of voice, which is, I think tone of voice is a vastly underrated distinctive brand asset that has been so important in building this brand and almost seamlessly transitioning it between those two phases. We haven't seen any backsliding in equity at all.
Danielle, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that this team is also very good at doing and can only happen, I think, when you've been through the teenage years and the trenches and sort of getting real and we can strategize ourselves to death. But at the end of the day, coming back to that direct pillar of our tone of voice, of bold, direct with heart, really grounds us sometimes, you know? And it was like, we got very strategic and very heady about the benefit of getting anything that you want at any time that you want. And at the end of the day, it came back to executions that were very much like, just tell people that we now deliver eats and don't eats. You know, just tell people who are already thinking, anything? Really? You get anything? Like what? And, you know, get almost anything came from a strategic narrative that was the positioning of the brand was to go from online food delivery to getting anything. So get tonight, you know, get dinner to get anything. And then we sat in rooms and we're like, well, it's not anything. So let's just say that it's actually almost anything. And then almost anything became a container for us to have a playful discussion with our consumers about what we did and didn't deliver. which really is, you know, it might feel different. It might be a different execution, but it has the same tonality, the same qualities that people understand about our brand. They go with us on the jokes. They understand we're self-deprecating. They understand we're going to say, holy crap, did a brand just say they actually don't deliver anything, that they deliver almost anything? That's what we would say is very Uber Eats.
So it seems from the outside looking in that you guys produce a massive amount of creative work in the campaign, because there seems to be this wonderful variety that's fresh every time I come across it. Is that true, or are you just rotating work around the world, or is there a ton of regionality? I mean, how do those assets, creative assets and spots, travel, or do they?
I think that we've been very pleased to see that they do travel. They travel organically, I'll be honest. It's not, we don't do a lot of rip and replace. So we don't run, we do sometimes, but we very rarely run the same thing in the US and in the UK or in APAC. We execute from either the same strategic narrative or the same brand platform. So we take Get Almost Anything, and then we localize it based on the local celebrities, the local jokes, the local culture, depending on where it's being executed, for example. But then there are other markets where they've taken a different approach to get the strategic narrative, which is Get Anything, and done things like the new verticals campaign that you saw in the UK, that's about the art of doing less. So it's all from the same strategic place, if not from the same brand platform place. But there is a massive amount of work that happens. There also is a massive amount of work from the perspective of there's Get Almost Anything, the brand campaign. There's also Yes and No, which is a Get Almost Anything campaign that has more of a retail layer. There is also Uber One, which is a membership that very much leans heavily into the Uber Eats brand, because the majority of membership is eaters who order quite a lot of food per month. That's where you see the most benefit. And so the combination, I think, of the fact that there are multiple lines of business running multiple campaigns in one market, and also that some of the UK work or the US work is traveling to Australia organically, or the Australia work is traveling to the US organically, what the combination effect is that you're just seeing a lot from the brand.
If I was involved in that campaign, I'd be thinking, I am doing the work of my life here for my career. This has got to be a thrill for you guys to be a part of this. Is it feel that way to you? Because I can imagine it must.
I mean, it's the role of a lifetime for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think that I came out of agencies very skeptical about what it would be like to go brand side. I think that the hardest thing that you think about being an agency creative is like, well, I can work on many clients versus working on one client. But, you know, as the discussion has proven even today, Uber is so many different clients inside one business. So, you know, I'm very lucky that I lead the entire global team. So I work with Special in Australia and in APAC on Uber Eats. And then I work with Special LA in the US on Uber Eats, but I also get to work with a wide variety of folks that are like me in terms of agency relationships across the globe on everything, on, you know, our earner work, our rides work, our health work, our B2B work, our Uber Eats work. Like, it's so huge, and there's always something really fun to do that for a creative person, it's like, it absolutely is Christmas morning all the time. And then in addition, I also run my own team. So things like content and storytelling that are fast moving or need to be very reactive, you know, I get to do both things. I get to do world-class creative work above the line, through the line in the regions, but then also world-class content that is about building a brand. And while I think that the advertising world and the industry is starting to really perk up about this work that we do, you know, on TV and this brand that we're building, I still don't feel like we're set in the same circles as Apple and Google, and we should be. And that is my mission. Those are the things that keep me feeling like 4 years later, I'm just getting warmed up. Like, you know, it's so fun. There's so much to do. Very rarely do you get the opportunity to come to an organization that has both the scale of the size of this place and the opportunity to rewrite the brand. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, you're right. It's so tough to come across it. A couple of last questions. One would be making a connection between marketing spend and investment and result. Do you have your way of looking at that? And have you been able to sort of draw some high level conclusions in terms of what works best and what works less so in terms of how you're executing it?
Yeah, I think that the measurement strategy internally at Uber, even the last 4 years that I've been here, has been profound. The progress has been just amazing in terms of what we track, what we measure, how we use our media agencies to help us, how we track above the line, through the line, performance media, et cetera. It's just there's so much more that we're learning about what's working to drive the business. While it's very hard to talk about sort of the proprietary data of those learnings, I think what I will say is that I have watched with the help of our partners, with the help of folks like Celia and the special team, I have watched us go from, you know, being marketers in a tech company to being absolutely partners in driving the business.
It's almost as if Uber could become a great retail media platform.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep, definitely. More on that, hey?
There's been so many conversations about, you know, whether performance should lead or brand should lead, or whether it's data science or it's creativity. It's because I always have that in mind. I don't think that you have to trade off creativity to be business driving. I've never felt that way. And so I think that this role and this experience that I've had has been such amazing validation in that. And it's certainly what I'm most proud of, is just not having to make the trade-off for really beautiful, enviable, creative work that's actually moving our business. I don't think that you would see the support of our executive leadership team with the amount of investment if it wasn't working.
Exactly.
It is both long-term brand building, but it is also real-time results. And I feel a huge sense of obligation to the business, and I feel a huge obligation to my family as a shareholder in Uber. And I absolutely love the validation of the fact that those two things can coexist.
It is Danielle Hawley, head of global brand and creator for Uber Eats and many other properties within the Uber portfolio, and she's in California. And Celia Garforth is head of strategy. She's based at the Special Agency in Australia. And of course, those guys are servicing the brand around the world. Thank you both for an amazing conversation and an amazing sort of journey through the last hour. We're going to put all the work up on our site, and we'll bake a lot of it into the episode edit. So thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It was awesome. And we will see everyone on the next episode.